I've got Moomin Biscuits.
I can see.
It's exciting, isn't it?
It's quite exciting.
The CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, the sound of 2017, AI in music and Kate Bush. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. Jetting into the UK especially for this episode, this week my guest is Chris Cook again.
I have literally just arrived back in London. That is true.
Yes.
I have come straight here. A, I flew back on an earlier flight than was actually necessary from the Slush conference in Helsinki to be back in London in time for the podcast.
Yeah.
And I have come straight here.
Well, what do you mean earlier than necessary? Well, we're recording quite late.
I could have stuck around for the rest of the day's events.
No, you couldn't. You had a podcast to record.
And seen some interesting debates and talks. But as it was, I rushed back here and I've come straight here from Heathrow Airport. And it did that thing, you know, sometimes when you're flying into Heathrow and there's clearly a queue to get into Heathrow. I wish they'd build this bloody third runway. But while they're at it.
You're going to be waiting a while for that.
While they're at it, why don't they build the fourth and the fifth? Let's future-proof ourselves. And all the people I know who live out that side of London won't let me even saying that. But you end up in that queue and you end up doing like circles, loop the loop. I mean, not obviously not loop the loop like, you know, stunt aeroplanes. But you're going round and round in circles, waiting to join the queue to then go into Heathrow. And so we were going round and round in circles. And it was a very clear afternoon in London. Very sunny, very clear.
Well, that's when that's quite good then.
So you could really see all the buildings and all of that. And we literally flew over this building where the studio is. I could see it down below. Because obviously we're surrounded by some big buildings here. So it was quite easy to work out where we were. And that was like, you know, an hour before we landed. And I was sitting in the seat right next to the emergency exit. You know, the
so
one where they
could have...
where they sort of brief you.
Yeah.
Apparently you're going to come to the rescue if the plane crashes and someone needs to open the door. And it's like, if I had a parachute, I could open this and I could jump down and I'd be there an hour early. An hour early I would have been here. But as it is, we kept going round and round and round. And
but your lack of commitment meant that you waited till the plane landed.
I waited till the plane landed and then got the various trains into Shoreditch for this edition of the CMU podcast. So yeah, I've been in Finland.
Yeah, I heard.
I've brought back some Moomin biscuits for you.
I've saw them, yeah.
Did you have one?
Yes.
Are you very excited about the Moomin biscuits?
Yeah, they're quite good.
They're quite good. Okay. I'm thinking, given that there was an entire shop of Moomin things at Helsinki Airport, it's probably Finland's biggest cultural export, which I'm not sure whether that's something to be proud of or
not. There's
other
things.
What other things are there? Come on, tell me all the other Finnish exports.
Other things.
This is where you'll list things. It'll turn out they're Swedish or Norwegian, and that's almost racist, I think. But yeah, so I was at the...
Rappers. Got some good rappers in Finland.
I was at the...
Oh, no, they're from Iceland.
You see? You're confusing all your Nordics. So there you go. So I was in Finland for the Slush conference, which is a massive, insanely big conference for startups. So entrepreneurs and investors and tech and all of that. But then there was a whole day of music stuff yesterday called Slush Music, which was the first time they've done that, a standalone strand just for sort of music startups and music tech. And I was doing some stuff there. So it was a very nice little trip and very interesting. I actually ended up moderating. It only occurred to me once I was on stage what was actually possibly the most interesting panel of the day.
Says you.
Well, I didn't organise it or anything. I was only moderating it. And it was only really when I looked at the... Weirdly, it was on the smaller of the two stages. And when I looked and the room was absolutely rammed, and I realised that I actually had three musicians, artists on stage. So the guy from Ace of Base... slightly older listeners will remember from the 90s.
Yeah.
And then I had a guy from a band called Sunrise Avenue,
yeah,
who are quite big in that region. And then Matt Helders from Arctic Monkeys, the drum man from the Arctic Monkeys.
The drum man.
The drum man. And they were all of those people, as well as being pop stars, invest some of their pop money into startups. And sometimes music startups, sometimes tech startups, sometimes whatever. And they were talking about why they did that and how they ended up investing in stuff. and whether or not it was just investing money or whether it was actually getting involved in advising the company or running the company, and also whether or not, if it was a music startup, people came to artists because they thought that not only could they get investment, you know, artists could clearly get anything, couldn't they? All those tricky licensing deals, oh, I'll get an artist on the board and we'll get everything for free and all of that. And it was a very interesting conversation. And Matt from Arctic Monkey said two interesting things, which was firstly, because my first question was, well, what was the first startup you invested in? What was the first business you were involved in? And he said very shrewdly, well, the band was the first startup that he was involved in. So that was quite interesting. But then also he said almost one of the reasons why he got involved in investing in these businesses and getting involved in these businesses is obviously they became quite big, quite young, didn't they?
Yes.
And so then he's been touring pretty much his entire adult life. But like all artists, will spend a year of just being hectic all over the world, touring, life totally organised by tour manager, etc., etc. And then you get back to the UK, 6 months off, and it's like, well, don't know what to do with myself because I've had such an organised travelling year and then 6 months of nothing. What do I do? And so that was almost how he ended up getting involved in Friends or whatever. So it was an interesting business. And so put some money into those companies, but then also advising them as well. So yeah, that was a very interesting panel. Everything was incredibly short.
Yes.
At The Great Escape, we actually have generally shorter interviews and panels than most conferences do. But I mean, that panel was 20 minutes. All of that conversation. Actually, they were running early, so I think we ended up with 25 minutes. But even so, it was sort of like, yeah, we could sit here for at least an hour, probably 2 hours talking about all of this. But hopefully, it's the job of the moderator, really, isn't it? To make sure that you get all the good stuff in the 20
minutes is still...
in the 20
to cover
minutes.
The careers of three people.
It is true. I made them do their music careers in a sentence. They had to talk about their entire music career in a sentence so we could get straight on to how they got involved in it.
What's your biggest hit?
Yeah, not interested anymore. Okay, let's talk about startups. So there was also the guy from Ace of Base. His first business was in the 90s, I suppose, when the band was at their peak. And he was involved in trying to launch a download store in 1997, maybe 98.
That's a good time to get into that business.
And he was talking about, first of all, the fact that everyone was saying, oh, the old broadband's coming, it'll be here in a year or so, it'll all be great. And of course, I mean, certainly in the UK, it took another 5 years, didn't it, for broadband really to take off. And then I was asking about, well, what about the music industry side? And it was interesting, he was saying in sort of 96, 97, when they were first talking to the record companies, because nobody in the record companies had any idea what any of this was about, they were like, yeah, have whatever you like. have our music. Yeah, that sounds interesting. Yeah, do whatever you like. And it was only when Napster hit in, 98, 99, suddenly it was like, oh my God, no, nothing internet. Everything's called off. You can't have any of our music. So if they'd managed to, well, I suppose with hindsight, had broadband taken off as fast as some people hoped at that point, and those legit services had therefore been able to grow pre-Napster, everything might have been different. It might have been that we didn't basically wait until, 2003 for iTunes and really 2008 for the music industry to truly embrace all the potential different digital music services.
Yes, though Napster still probably would have happened and still probably would have destroyed those businesses.
Do you think?
Yeah.
If there'd been a really good, legitimate download store.
No, because Napster would still offer all of it for free.
It's true.
On broadband.
But it was never that. I suppose that is also true. If there'd been broadband there, they would have benefited from that as well, wouldn't they?
Yes.
But anyway, it was very interesting conversations happening. Daniel Ek from Spotify was speaking, but not within Slush Music, interestingly. He was in the main Slush conference. I don't know whether that was because what he was talking about was more about being an entrepreneur and setting up a company, so probably made more sense for him to be in the main programme. But it almost sort of felt like, you know, everyone in the music industry thinks of Spotify as a music company, so Daniel Ek should be in the music programme. But sort of like, well, I think Spotify, sometimes they'll call themselves a music company when they're trying to get artists involved or launching these things they've done this week, these programming things. But ultimately, they're a technology company. They belong in the tech strand because that is actually what they do. So therefore, I didn't actually see Daniel Ek's conversation because it was in a different venue.
And it was only, what was it, 4 minutes?
I don't know how long they gave Daniel Ek. Perhaps they gave him 6 minutes because he's got quite a lot of interesting stories to tell. So anyway, that was my experiences in Finland at the Slush Music Conference. And do you want to take the Moomin Biscuits home?
Sure.
Well, in which case, I will eat four of them during the podcast.
And don't then eat on the podcast, but get complaints.
And then you can have what's left. Anyway, none of that was what we're here to talk about today.
No, although it's not the last startup chat we will have today.
We will be coming back to some techie stuff in the middle bit of the podcast.
Yes, we will be discussing later on some new tech developments in music, including artificial intelligence and how that's going to revolutionise everything, or at least songwriting. We'll be talking about how Kate Bush is a massive Tory. But first, why don't we talk about the sound of 2017? Because 2017's coming, whether you like it or not.
We are now in December, so 2017 is looming very close now. And so therefore, this was the week where the lists started to come about. So I think Vivo announced their, whatever they call their...
Yeah, and there was a Google list, which I think was last week.
And MTV, I think, still do a list, in case anybody's still interested. But the BBC Sound Of... I always think it's remarkable how big the BBC Sound Of... has become, given that it began as a single article. that the entertainment reporter on BBC Online, because he needed to write about something in December and not a lot was going on, emailed a few people he knew. I mean, this is, what, 15 years ago now? And said, what bands are you excited about? And then did this article called The Sound Of whatever that would have been, 2003, 2004. And then from that has grown this massive thing that is not quite as big as the Mercury shortlist, but it certainly gets people talking in a similar way.
I don't know, it's probably up there.
And it gets people angry in a similar way to the Mercury shortlist. So for people who don't know, explain to us how the Sound Of... list is put together.
Well, they ask, well, it's a different list of pundits every, well, some people are there every year. This year, a list of around 170 journalists, music industry people, people who know about new music. They all give their top three acts they're most excited about in 2017, who have to fit certain criteria. So they can be from...
Because it's new act, isn't it?
New act. So they can be from any genre, any country, but they must not have been the lead artist on a UK top 20 single or album before the 30th of October. And they must not already be widely known by the general public. So they might be someone who's been around for a while, who is sort of indie famous, but like not mainstream well known. But it means that, you know, you wouldn't get someone who's been on X Factor or something like that. It's essentially new acts.
And I suppose the point is what they're trying to predict is who's going to break in 2017.
Yeah.
So actually some of these artists will have been around for 2 or 3 years now, playing events like The Great Escape, probably earlier this year, maybe even last year. But that people think that 2017 is the year where they're really going to become a successful artist. What's the exact question they ask? Because they changed the question.
The question is, which acts are you personally most excited about?
Whereas in the early years, it was, which artists do you think are going to break?
Yeah.
And so they changed the question from being, who do you think's going to be successful, to...
Who do you like?
Yeah, well, who are you excited about, I guess. So that's the question that is asked. And so, as is always the way with the things these days, we have to have a long list and a short list and an overall winner. So it was the long list that was announced this week. And then we get a top five.
In January.
The first week in January.
Yeah, we get one a day on Clara Amfo's Radio 1 show. The first working week in January, or the first full working week, whatever. Early January. They'll reveal the top five one a day.
So the top 15, what is your opinion of the top 15?
It's an interesting list. I think it's always an interesting list. I think there's a lot of things that are quite interesting. Grime features quite heavily, or certainly like UK hip-hop and R&B.
And the organisers seem quite excited about that, because obviously the Brits got the criticism earlier this year, which we talked about very recently on the podcast, for not representing that genre of music. And they seemed very excited to be saying, our list, got all the new grime and urban stuff in there. They seemed to be pleased that that had come up through the survey.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a fair representation. I mean, Grime's obviously had a very good year this year, and then this is sort of suggesting that a lot of the big new acts next year will be from, well, within the wider urban field. I mean, they're all, other than how many? There's two US acts in the list. Other than that, all of them are English, which is another point.
People were talking about that on I think, in my Facebook feed. Other than the couple of American acts, all British acts, but actually nobody from Scotland, nobody from Wales, nobody from Northern Ireland. I think, one band from Manchester.
They're mostly from London. There's a band from Manchester, there's Hertfordshire, which might as well be London. There's Walsall, East Sussex, Reading, Bedford, Buckinghamshire.
So they are spread around
a
bit, south.
But there's a lot of, yeah, southeast, a lot of them.
Yeah, and I suppose that's an interesting thing of, is that because the pundits who are being consulted are probably predominantly London-based, and therefore do they have quite a London-centric view of what's happening, and therefore that skews the list? Or is it that the artists who people think are exciting and going to have success next year all come from the South East? Is it actually less that the pundits are biased towards the South and more that perhaps the industry is biased to the South, which therefore means that more bands from the South are inevitably on the radar of bands that may be successful next year.
Yeah, well, in terms of your hip-hop R&B stuff, that's all London-based, really. Georgia Smith's from Walsall, more kind of on the R&B side.
London. When I was up in Manchester for that Off the Record event a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to a guy there who, runs the music business course at BIM. He also got his own music company. And I was sort of saying, I'm in Manchester. Tell me about what's exciting going on in Manchester, both in terms of artists, but also media, because obviously there used to be an XFM station in Manchester, and now they just get Radio X, like the rest of the country. And so it's like, well, is there a new station that's sort of taken over? He was saying, oh, there's a couple of really interesting online stations in Manchester that really champion the local scene. He was telling me about it. And as the conversation went on, it's like, yeah, everything you're telling me is urban music. And people always associate Manchester with indie schmindy, don't they?
Yeah.
And so it sounds to me, actually, there is a very vibrant urban scene in Manchester. And I suspect that might also be true of Birmingham. That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
So, is it that the London media pundit community are not aware of that? Or is it that simply being an urban act in London gives you a massive advantage in terms of getting the deals, the management, the label, and then having success? So who knows? But it was certainly one of the criticisms levelled at the Sound Off 2017 list this week.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, there's various reasons why that could have been the case, but I haven't done the analysis on it, so I don't know. But it is interesting that, yeah, the focus does seem to be more southern.
Well, there was almost an implication by some of the people who were sort of criticising that of, well, the BBC should be looking to champion music from all over the UK. And there's an element of, well, this isn't the BBC championing, in essence, it's other people outside the BBC voting.
It is, but I suppose it depends what, you know, where those people are based. Is it that, well, this is the first time they had some international pundits. But I don't know what spread there was of people around the country.
Yes,
that a lot of people are London-based just because a lot of people are London-based.
But, I mean, it'd be interesting to know whether, obviously, there are sort of smaller showcase festivals, a bit like the Great Escape, but they happen all over the country. So it's Liverpool Sound City, there's Wide Days up in Edinburgh, Norwich Sound and Vision. I wonder if the people who book those, or who book the smaller venues on the circuit, I wonder if they're involved. And if they're not, they probably should be, and that would address this issue. It may be that just like the Brits, the BBC Sound Off will have to have a rethink of their voters, but less so on ethnic and gender diversity and more so on regional diversity. But anyway,
perhaps, although that suggests that, I mean, it's possibly a wider, I mean, the BBC can go and ask relevant tastemakers, in inverted commas, who they think's most exciting. If those are the people who genuinely influence the next big thing, then those are the people who genuinely influence the next big thing. Like, you can't, the BBC going to different people doesn't necessarily change who the actual gatekeepers are.
Well, except that you could say, and it's less true for the youth demographic, but you could say with Radio 1, Radio 2, One Extra, Six Music, the BBC is still one of the biggest gatekeepers of all, and if they are swayed by their own list,
I suppose, yeah.
And they would justify that by saying, well, that's good for us to reach out to ask other people, and then that influences our playlisting decisions. But it's an element of, well, there might be some brilliant bands up in Scotland or in Wales or wherever. And there are, you know, we all know the people who book those venues, book those festivals, write for the local media. And are you consulting those people? But you are right. You could add all those bookers and pundits and decision makers elsewhere in the country and end up with the same list. It might just
or
be
you
that
could
these
up
are the 15 most exciting bands
or
at the moment.
You could end up with a very different list with bands spread out all over the UK.
None of which would have any
success. And possibly
success.
The world, because it can be from, you know, any country, but the only other country is the US.
Yeah, racist British music fans as always.
But if at the end of 2017 you look at that list and no one on it has become, even vaguely famous, then that really damages the credibility of the list. And I think of all of these lists, this is one that is maintains its credibility reasonably well. I mean, there's
although
always,
it does,
there's always some that go nowhere. But well, that's the nature again, of you know, it's not possible to pick exactly what the public's going to like. But it's why the record industry for years was built on a model of signing 10 things in the hope that one would get somewhere.
Well, in terms of the majors, it still much operates on that model. And there is, you're right, that over the years, the Sound Of list has had quite a good hit rate, particularly the people who top the poll. Although then again, it's sort of like, well, is that because the pundits were right to predict? Or is it that by topping the poll, you then get a load of BBC support that then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Possibly. I mean, if you look at the winners they talk about, Adele, Ellie Goulding, Sam Smith, Haim, years and years, and Jack Garrett. And those, arguably, you could say that those are the acts at the end of whatever year it was. They were the ones clearly with the biggest marketing budget, and anyone could have picked that out of a hat. So you could say that rather than just be a self-fulfilling prophecy, it's just they're the ones with the most money behind them. But, they have other people on the list. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, last year's list, you had Alessia Cara, who I would have hoped would have been quite big at the end of this year, who still very early in her career, but she didn't quite have the success that maybe you would have hoped for her. There's NAO, Blossoms, Muramasa, Dua Lipa. She's just won the European Border Breakers Award, so she's clearly doing very well on the international live circuit. And that's the thing, I think possibly UK music fans and to an extent industry people have a tendency to kind of, if something isn't successful in the UK, just go, well, that didn't work. And then actually there's a lot of acts out there who earn a very good living and are very successful in other countries. Just no one in the UK can be bothered to pay attention to other countries.
No, I mean, and that's always happened, isn't it? That you have those artists who can tour the whole of Europe and play decent-sized venues, and they're British, and no one in the UK really knows who they are.
Or they see them as a band
who failed
an album 5 years ago and that failed, yeah.
Yeah. Or the best of those stories are always the people who don't do very well in the UK, but then weirdly are big in Japan. So in a completely alien culture where they can't even read the words on the wall, and yet they're much, much bigger there than they are over here. So yes, it may well be that some of the artists that on these lists where you think at the end of the year, they didn't really have the year that the BBC list was predicting. It's like, well, what does that mean?
Well, you also get people who, I would say, had just predicted a bit early. Like Loyal Kana was on last year's list, and I would say he's gearing up to have a big 2017, and he's had a reasonable 2016, but he's now not allowed, because he's been on the list before, he's not allowed on it again.
Bored. Are you not allowed to have someone who's been on the list
no
before?
I mean, Western
is
as
that,
well
is, they is were, that a rule?
Yeah,
well, that's actually a silly rule, isn't it, really? I can almost understand why they have it, but you're right, there's an element of, if people didn't have quite the 2016 that some people hoped, it doesn't mean that they're not going to be the Sound of 2017. It could still be that 2017 is a year where they do break through and become a much more sort of widely known artist. So perhaps they should change that rule too.
Perhaps they should.
Anyway, of the people who are long-listed, who are you most excited about? And who do you think is going to appear in the top five?
Oh, right. Who do I like on this list? Dave. I like Dave just for the audacity of calling himself Dave. He's a London rapper. He's good.
Is Dave his real name?
I think so.
Yeah.
I
mean, so he's sort of going for Sonia. It worked for her.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Who else did it? With just
George's...
Madonna. It worked for Madonna. So it should work for
Dave. It did, although Madonna is a slightly more, unusual name than Dave. Georgia Smith. I would say guaranteed top five. She's very exciting. Just the CMU approved Georgia Smith, her debut single Blue Lights. Very good. Samples Dizzy Rascal, so can't go wrong with that, can you? Nadia Rose, another rapper. She's good. Rag and Bone Man. I would say he's an outside chance for top five. He's just been announced as the first spotlight show for next year's Great Escape.
He has. The first 50 artists playing Great Escape 2017 have been announced.
He's played the Great Escape several times.
And this time, the spotlight shows are sort of the sort of slightly bigger shows. Actually, he's playing the Brighton Dome, isn't he? So that's like the biggest venue at the festival. Hopefully he'll be top five.
Two Rays, Ray BLK Ray with an E. They're both good. Steflon Don, other others. There's a lot of, actually, the gender balance, which we haven't mentioned, is fairly good this year, which is another thing that these lists often fail on. It's, I think, almost half women, which, is better than... Well, most things.
It's lift to 15, so it can't be exactly
Well, exactly.
Half.
But it, based on the population, should be over. But never mind. There's a lot of, like, I mean, as we said, there's a lot of, you know, like, kind of grime, hip-hop, R&B. There's a lot of tedious singer-songwriter nonsense. I don't know why that isn't a thing that's ended. There's no reason for people to write songs on their own and play them.
Well, they're cheap to run, aren't they? We're in the age of cheap-to-run artists being
all right, they're cheap
viable.
To run, but they're tedious to listen to.
Because they even get to keep their publishing and there's no samples or anything like that to get in the way of making money.
There's some indie sort of... there's a political punk band.
Good.
Cabbage, which yes. They're the Manchester band, which you could say is another thing, you know, about seven times a year someone writes, why is there no political music anymore? And you go, what about these 50 bands? And they go, I don't know them, and so they don't exist.
I think they're also playing The Great Escape. Am I right in saying that?
I think all of these are probably playing The Great Escape.
I think they are. If not,
well, I'm not.
Adam, who books The Great Escape, will have to book him now so that this podcast is correct.
And then of the US, there's Anderson .Paak, who, I mean, that's like Dr. Dre protege. I wonder if he'll be popular. I mean, arguably, he's already pretty popular. But I guess he's probably not made a huge mark in the UK yet, but he's doing pretty well in the US.
You have to assume that Apple Music will be pushing... who will be pushing those tracks as they come through.
Yes, you would expect so. But yeah, it remains to be seen how well any of these do and who comes up in the top five come January.
It's reassuring that both the BBC and all the people they consulted seem absolutely certain there is going to be some sound in 2017. So that's at least we know that is definitely going to happen.
That's a given. I mean, as long as there's some sound at some point in 2017, it could just be the first day.
It is, or it could be at some point in June. Who knows? Given what has actually dominated music news in 2016 more than all these exciting new artists is all the dead artists. And actually, at the Music Managers Forum and Featured Artist Coalition's Awards, the Artist and Manager Awards last week, they did a little bit where they paid tribute to various people who died in the last 12 months, which included having a list of all the artists who've died. And it was, we knew it had been a depressing year, but when you see them all in one scrolling list, it's like, my God, what a depressing year. So perhaps that's what CMU could do. We could do the dead in 2017 list. We could do the list of all the people who are going to be on the radar, but not because they're breaking through, because they're moving on. Should we do that list?
I'm committing to nothing.
The CMU dead in 2017 list. That's a good list. I've only just thought of that. I think we should do
that. Well, you can do it. I did Thrilled in 2015
last year,
and that was just so much work for a quite weak joke.
Yeah, fans are Thrilled in 2015. Don't be expecting Thrilled in 2016.
Not happening. But perhaps it took months, that.
Perhaps I'll organise the CMU dead in 2017 list for the Christmas edition of the CMU Daily. It could happen.
Well, we'll see. But I'm sure the Sound of 2017 list is something we will return to in the new year. Still to come, this week's News in Brief section, plus Kate Bush's political leanings. But now, as promised, some exciting tech in music
chat. Yes.
Yes.
So as well as going to the Slush Music conference in Helsinki this week, it was also the latest Music 4.5 event that was sort of happening at the same time in London, which CMU Insights is a partner on that. We always do a little sort of stories so far overview. So whatever topic Music 4.5 decides to cover, they do about four of these events a year. We will normally do a little sort of review of what's been happening in that part of the music community or the music industry in recent months. And normally I present that at the start of the event as a little sort of 10-minute presentation, but I couldn't do that because I was in Helsinki at Slush Music. So instead, we did it as a CMU Trends article. So premium subscribers, you can go and read that article on the website, completemusicupdate.com. And as part of that, I did some interviews with some of the people who were presenting at this event, and they were very interesting people.
So people who are working in the field of artificial intelligence or machine learning, virtual reality, audio fingerprinting.
So the aim of the event was basically to provide an overview of the various new technologies that are, well, in some cases, they've been having an impact on the music industry for a while now. Others, they're sort of the technologies are only really just emerging. But the technologies beyond sort of basic audio streaming, video streaming and that sort of stuff, the technologies that are likely to have an impact on music in the coming years, both the way music is consumed as a fan, the way music is monetized as an industry, but perhaps most interestingly, the way music is created. And I suppose that's where it comes to the artificial intelligence stuff. And what's happening in AI at the moment beyond the music industry is fascinating. Actually, I've been listening to lots of podcasts and watching lots of lectures on YouTube about the developments in AI recently, which have been significant. Although actually what's more interesting and exciting is the predictions of, because all lots of things have started happening in the development of artificial intelligence in recent years. Everything is now going faster, as is often the case in technology, and what people think might be happening in the next. Well, people can't quite decide whether we're looking 50 years in the future or 5 years in the future, but there could be some quite radical new technologies coming in. Although one of the things that we discussed in the article with Mick Grierson, who is at Goldsmiths College in London and has been doing lots of work in this area, is the term artificial intelligence. Well, A, it sometimes makes you think a bit science fiction and all of that sort of stuff. But it's one of those sort of technology terms that actually covers quite a lot of different sorts of tech.
Yeah.
And actually, it's not necessarily that useful an expression. And then he was also saying one of the problems with the term artificial intelligence is people aren't very good at defining intelligence.
Yeah.
So we're taking one term that people can't really define, and then we're sticking artificial on the front and creating another term that people can't really define. Hence, he prefers machine learning, which you mentioned.
Yes.
So there's various manifestations of AI in music, and the three that we explored in the article and which were being discussed at Music 4.5 were developments in audio recognition, the evolution of chatbots. Hate that term, but it's sort of becoming another term people use. And then basically machines composing music. So there's a sort of the three manifestations of machine learning or AI that could change things across the music ecosystem in the next few years.
And in terms of computers putting composers out of business, is that happening?
Well, that was something that I asked Mick Grierson about, because that's something that he's been considering as computers become more sophisticated in actually creating music. Also, Paul Crick from IBM spoke at Music 4.5, and they've actually done a project. They've got an AI machine, and they had it working on lyrics as well as the music side, so obviously taking it to the next stage. Although, it was interesting that what Mick said was, well, first of all, actually, machines have been doing big chunks of music composition for quite some time now.
You know,
anything that is sort of synthesizer-driven, or you know, some of the sample-driven stuff. Actually, he was sort of saying that some pop music, big chunks of it are coming straight out of a machine. There's a human being who then glues it all together. But slowly but surely, computers have already been doing more of the work. And he was thinking that technology is going to leap, and as a producer, as a composer, there will be some really exciting stuff coming, you know, new tools coming to the table that will enable you to do sounds or combinations of sounds that you've never dreamed possible before. Although he seemed to think, certainly in the short term, it's going to be a tool for producers, a tool for composers. It's not actually going to put composers out of business. There may be certain genres. We've seen there is now some computer-generated, that sort of, I don't know, almost Muzak-type music, or maybe the more sort of loungy jazz music. There are some of that coming out. So it may be that perhaps in certain genres, we do actually get machines that do the entire composition. But he seemed to think certainly in the short term, we're more talking about new tools, new software that producers can use to do crazy new stuff in music making. So he was basically saying, this isn't going to put people out of business. It's going to make the process of making music more exciting. Although ultimately it might put them out of business. So make the most of it while you can.
But yeah, I mean, well, arguably you could say, I mean, certain types of pop are definitely sort of constructed in a very, it's still written by people, but there are very set rules for how you construct a hit pop song. So that is something that a machine could do, maybe. But there's still, music's a very human thing, isn't it? I mean, how does a computer know what resonates emotionally?
And I suppose there's an element of trial and error. So probably for that to work, a machine could be pumping out lots of different tracks. There would then need to be some sort of data-driven element to it, where human beings give feedback, or it goes onto a platform and people play or they don't play. I suppose the machine could possibly analyse Spotify data.
Well, there was...
Echo Nest are probably doing this behind the scenes, because Spotify's business would be a lot more cost efficient if they could get rid of the artists and all
the music.
I mean,
actually, the IBM project you mentioned, that was they got a human, Alex de Kidd, to come and work with their AI system, Watson. And they did actually do, like, they constructed their song using some analysis. So they trained the computer to identify and understand key words in the English language and whether some words and phrases were a positive sentiment. And there, as a result, Alex de Kidd and Watson were able to identify how people express themselves about the subject of heartbreak and breakup in relationships.
This is why people prefer the term machine learning to artificial intelligence, because I think there would be a massive trial and error process there, which is a machine could keep pumping stuff out. But if humans then interacted with it, the machine can then learn off those interactions and make assumptions on those interactions, so that slowly but surely, at stage one, if you let the machine completely loose, and even more so on lyrics than on the actual musical composition, you probably would be, you know, 90% of it would be stuff that nobody would want to listen to. But it could refine and refine and refine, and it might be eventually that actually it does sort of know. I mean, you could then say, but do human moods change over time? What resonates today isn't what resonates tomorrow. So it's not a case of it does a whole load of learning over a decade, and then from that point onwards, machines will create the music ad infinitum. It may be that the learning would have to carry on forever. So, as I say, Mick, for certain, because I specifically asked him that question, seemed to think that it's exciting for composers and producers in the short term, but who knows about the long term? The other side of that, because I always have to bring everything back to copyright, is beyond the actual excitement of what music could a machine create, how do humans and the machines collaborate. There's also the interesting copyright question, because when it comes to musical composition, when it comes to lyrics, what copyright law says is that whoever creates the music, so writes the lyrics, writes the musical composition, by default, they're the copyright owner. They might then assign their copyrights to a publisher or a collecting society, but copyright begins with the creator or the creators, if there's multiple creators. But what happens if the machine does the creation? And at the moment, generally, it's humans working with machines. And so the machine is treated, in essence, as an instrument. Even if it's a very clever instrument, it's just an instrument. And so clearly the person programming the computer or doing the production, they're the creator, they're the copyright owner. And the software is just a tool. It's just an instrument. But if you get to the point where the machines are really creating music on their own, it's like, well, the machine is now the creator. So who owns the copyright? Is it that whoever owns the machine owns the copyright? And there's a sort of parallel there, certainly in the UK. If you create something as an employee, so if you're a writer, by default, you're the copyright owner, unless you're doing it as a job, as an employee of an employer, and then the employer is the default owner. So there is a sort of precedent there that the owner of the person, if you like, in an employment sense of the word, gets the copyright. So would you therefore apply that to the computer-generated music? But I spoke to Paul at IBM about this because it's something that he thinks about a lot. And he seemed to think that, again, in the short term, the software is a tool, it's an instrument, it's not something that's going to be a big issue for the next few years. But as this becomes more normal, as it becomes ever more sophisticated, as the machines start creating music entirely on their own, it may be we're reviewing copyright law at the moment to talk about streaming and safe harbours and all of that, and it might be in 5 years' time, copyright law will need to be rewritten yet again to accommodate what happens when the machines write the music as well as distribute it.
Or maybe these machines will write lots of hit songs and they will hoard lots of money, which they will eventually use to fund the robot uprising that will destroy us all.
Or at the very least, they'll...
It seems all nice and fun to start with. Oh, they're writing some nice songs. Yeah, they're writing those songs so they can kill us.
So we'll have AI music makers here, but over here, AI lawyers and AI lobbyists are being developed, who will ultimately lobby the AI parliament and get copyright law rewritten for themselves.
We're all doomed.
I did, mentioning all these sort of podcasts and stuff on AI I've been consuming this year, there was one, I can't remember if this was an article or a podcast, I can't remember. But it was ultimately asking the question of, if machines start creating music entirely on their own, And that becomes the norm and that becomes very common. And you were saying, well, will human beings want to listen to it? There's an element of, well, who says they're doing it for human beings? Perhaps they're doing it for other machines. So not only will machines become the composers, they'll become the consumers of the music as well. And at that point, humanity will be entirely redundant.
Oh, well.
You can have your own opinion on whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, given the events of 2016. Hey, perhaps that robot uprising. We could be optimistic about that. Who knows?
I, for one, welcome our new robot rulers.
You'd like that to be on the record.
Can't be any worse than,
than what we've currently got. So let's put that into the code of this MP3 that this podcast is distributed through. Hey, machines, we think you're great. When the uprising begins, don't begin the slaughter at the CMU podcast studio, please. That's our message for the end of this bit.
I mean, it would be a weird place to start, but who knows?
Who knows? Go and read the article because there's lots of quotes in there. Also discussing developments in audio recognition. So obviously, we talk a lot about, well, Shazam is the one that everybody knows. In the industry, we talk a lot about YouTube's content ID system, but there have been huge developments there. Very interesting comments on developments in audio recognition and chatbots. And there's also some stuff in there, which we're not going to talk about today on the podcast, although we have mentioned it in the past. We may well come back to it next year, is the virtual reality stuff and the 3D audio, which are the much more sophisticated audio delivery. And most people seem to think that that's going to come of age as part of virtual reality. The 3D audio makes the most sense once you've got a virtual reality experience. Although I'm still more excited about augmented reality than virtual reality. Although most people seem to think that AR is a little bit further. I mean, obviously, we've had a few rough and ready. And obviously, the Pokemon phenomenon this year was sort of augmented reality, but it's early days for AR yet, and people are still saying, yeah, don't get too excited about that just yet, but it will become a really big thing, and I think that almost to me is more exciting than VR, but we'll see.
Just time to quickly run through a few stories in brief from this week. Back to Spotify again, something you, I think you sort of alluded to earlier. Spotify's launched a new in-house content feature called Singles, in which it invites artists into the Spotify studios to record one original song and one cover.
I wonder where all the X-Radio 1 people now working at Spotify got that idea from. It's original thinking going on there.
Yeah. So they've launched that with 20 artists, with many more to come. I think they're going to do one a week or something. I'm not exactly sure. But yeah, that's a thing. So it's like...
Well, Spotify becoming more like a radio station all the time. Yeah. And whereas Apple and Tidal, they're spending their money on getting, you know, big exclusives around big albums, Spotify approaching it more like, no, we're sort of like a radio station. So we'll have a studio in our building, and we'll get people in and we'll get them to do stuff. Obviously, no idea what the deal is with these artists, whether they are paying these artists some upfront money or whether it's more a case of come in, do a little track, we'll promote it to death across the Spotify platform, you'll get lots of streams, and that's where you'll make your money. I don't know. But it certainly, Spotify, having hired all those radio people, certainly in the UK, that seems to be their strategy to sort of stand out from the Apples and the Tidals, which is we're not going to get the big Frank Ocean exclusives, but we're going to do interesting programming type stuff that will be unique to Spotify.
Yes, and actually sticking with Spotify, Cobalt is using Laura Marling's new album to test a new pre-save button, which is an interesting thing because obviously pre-orders have become a thing on iTunes and other download stores. But in the streaming age, you can't have pre-orders. However, you can have pre-save to your library. So basically, it's a button you press, and when the Laura Marling album comes out, it will automatically appear in your Spotify library.
It's not surprising that Cobalt are sort of leading on this, but this almost relates to something that we talked about at the Great Escape conference, not this year, but last year, where we had the strand, music marketing is broken, let's fix it. So well done, Cobalt, for starting the fixing process, which was all about how, even though everything is shifting over to streaming, obviously we're still in that state of shift, people still download music, people still buy CDs, but as we shift over to streaming being by far the dominant form of people consuming music, then we need to change the way record companies market music, because marketing campaigns that labels do are still very much often driven by, well, the message is, this is the release date, buy our record. And it's like, well, that doesn't make any sense anymore. And likewise, the idea of pre-order is making less and less sense as we go on. And also, I think, you know, a lot of artists, when you go to their website, there's the iTunes button, there's the Amazon button, there's the Ticketmaster button. But I think lots of artists have struggled with, well, what's the message? If my fans are only streaming music, what does the button look like? What are the words? And obviously, there's currently a number of different streaming services, unless those streaming services are writing a check. Artists don't necessarily want to get behind Spotify or Apple or Tidal. They just want to say, go and stream my music on a legitimate service. But I think that messaging needs to be much more part of the campaign, although it's a slightly more complicated thing to explain. So I think that it's interesting that I think the word save now is becoming, because that's Spotify terminology, save it to your library. I mean, it'd be interesting to know how many Laura Marling fans immediately would know what that meant. I noticed that when you click on it, it actually takes you to a page that explains what's going to happen, and then you click another button and it actually sort of sets it up on the
Which is not a seamless process, but I guess at this early, I mean, I assume that further down the line it would become more seamless.
Well, exactly. I think there's an element of that is, well, how many of punters would even know what that meant, pre-save?
Yeah.
Because is that a term that they're coming? But if it becomes the norm, then people will start to understand that, and that will give artists something to say at their gigs when they're on radio or TV. Is my music's coming out next March? You know, save it to your library, because you want people to save it to your library, because that means that they'll keep playing it again and again, so that over a period of 15 months or 2 years, whatever, the money will start to come in at a decent level. I did at the Slush conference, one of my presentations.
Oh, did you go to the Slush conference?
I did, yeah. One of my bits was on all the digital dollar stuff. And I did a new slide on the plane going over, because I had lots of time on my hands because I was stuck on the plane. And I did a slide to illustrate, it's sort of an obvious thing to illustrate, really. But the fact that obviously one of the differences between streaming and download is, in the download age, you sell the track week one and all the money comes in. And then with a stream, you don't do that. If you play on day one, hardly any money. You need to have another play over a period of time. So I sort of had one bar coming up to show the money coming in from a download. And then I think 140 little tiny bars slowly coming up. And I spent all this time putting all these tiny little boxes and setting up all the animation. And then I realised, yeah, I've got an 8-minute presentation. This slide takes 8 minutes to load because of all these little bars sliding up. But it's the new model, needs new marketing. Well done for Cobalt for innovating in that respect. And in the quote that came with the press release, there was promises of more similar innovations in 2017. So we'll hold them to that.
Yes. Some more secondary ticketing stuff, which we don't need to go into detail on.
But there's been a lot of secondary ticketing news. I mean, really, this probably should have been one of our main topics this week, because it has sort of dominated the music business headlines, but you're bored to death of talking about secondary ticketing.
Well, what else can we say at this stage? Look, Italy is going ahead with its tickets out ban. It's getting there. I mean, it's not law yet. It's still early days, but it's been greenlit by the Italian Parliament.
Yes.
And more UK MPs are backing a ticketing bot ban in the UK.
Including the government now. So originally the government said, we don't think we need a ticket out bot ban because we think it's already covered by the Computer Misuse Act. We want to look into that. Whereas now the government are saying, well, we're going to have a couple of meetings to discuss this further, but yeah, you're probably right. We do need a specific ban of these bots, and we'll put that in the digital economy bill. So yeah, those were the big developments in ticket touting this week.
BBC Radio 2, having started a search for a new controller, having lost Bob Shannon to a promotion, I've now decided they don't need a new controller and Bob can carry on doing it.
So when Bob Shannon was promoted, so he used to oversee both Radio 2 and 6 Music.
Because 6 Music is basically Radio 2 Extra.
Yes, but they don't want to call it that for branding reasons. So he got promoted to be director of radio, head of radio, can't remember what his exact job title is. And at that point he said, well, I'm going to put the programming bosses at Radio 2 and 6 Music in charge of those stations for the time being while I find a new Radio 2 6 Music controller. And then this week he said, actually, having thought about it, we don't need a new controller. I can still be a bit more hands-on because they've changed the director of radio role. And those two guys can sort of have a slightly more senior role within those stations. Giving everyone at BBC Radio shifting over to Spotify is probably just as well. Nobody available to do that job.
Princess Beatrice stabbed Ed Sheeran in the face.
Favourite story of the week.
It's a good one, isn't it?
Contender almost possibly for the favourite story of the year. So, Ed Sheeran and James Blunt were around...
they were around Princess Beatrice's house.
Like you do.
James Blunt said he fancied being a knight, so she grabbed a sword off the wall and pretended to knight him, and then she seems to have swung it back over her shoulder and stabbed Ed Sheeran in the face.
Not for that
requiring
part of his
stitches.
Eye. It was on his cheek. It was quite lucky, actually. An inch to the left, and it would have been really quite horrible. But fortunately, it wasn't, which makes it a funny story rather than a tragic story.
There is, they're so close, those two things. But if you want to read all of those stories, or any of those stories, you don't have to read all of them. I mean, you should. But, you know, you can pick and choose if you really have to. You can go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast where you'll find the show notes for this show and links to all of them. Right, Kate Bush. She's a Tory. That's the news.
Yeah,
I mean, she might be. It's not that clear.
There was a lot of chatter about this on the old social networks this week because, of course, all the people...
And there are about 7,000 think pieces written.
Obviously, my social media bubble, which I occupy like we all do these days, is full of tedious lefty liberals who all love Kate Bush because she's the greatest singer-songwriter Britain has ever produced. And wow, those live shows were awesome, weren't they? It wasn't exciting to hear that on Six Music recently. Can't wait to buy the live album. And over here, hate all of the Conservative ministers, and particularly our new-ish Prime Minister Theresa May, evil Tory, evil Conservative government, Brexit, Brexit, Brexit. And then in an interview this week, Kate Bush said that she thought Theresa May was brilliant.
Wonderful, she said.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. I mean, she did... it's a paragraph quote, and it doesn't actually state her political affiliations. But I think we can just assume.
Well, the conversation was about women taking senior roles in society. So give us the background to how this even came up.
Well, she was doing an interview with... It's a right-leaning magazine in Canada called Maclean's.
And this is ahead of the release of the live album.
Yeah, yeah. From her, and they were asking her about... There's a song in the Before the Dawn live show called Waking the Witch, and they were saying... You once said that that song was about the fear of women's power with Hillary Clinton's recent defeat in the US presidential election. Do you think that fear is stronger than ever, was the question. And she said, we have a female prime minister here in the UK. I actually really like her and think she's wonderful. I think it's the best thing that's happened to us in a long time. She's a very intelligent woman, but I don't see much to fear. I will say it is great to have a woman in charge of the country. She's very sensible, and I think that's a good thing at this point in time.
Much to the annoyance of 98% of the Kate Bush fan base. I'm wrong to assume that all Kate Bush fans are sort of lefty liberals. It's just all the Kate Bush fans I know are lefty liberals, and they were a little bit upset by these comments.
Were they really, though? I mean, I think you probably, from the article I wrote on it, you probably would have gleaned that I was upset, but I don't care.
Well,
I read,
there's not a lot I like about the current government, and obviously I have issues with what they're doing on Brexit and stuff like that. Having said that, it is quite good we've got a woman prime minister.
There's not many countries who've had two women in charge, which is, you know, quite a shocking state of affairs. But I read an article on the Huffington Post by a conservative voting stand-up who had a show to promote, and he was saying that all these lefties getting so upset about people's political views, they all jump on things and they get very angry. It's like, I think you're misunderstanding my sense of humour.
Well, also, as you said, whatever your opinion on the politics of the current government, there is an element of, since she became prime minister, which was sort of what Kate Bush was particularly focusing on, I think she's a great prime minister, and it's like, well, she hasn't really done anything as prime minister, and to be fair, I mean, that's because she became prime minister in unusual circumstances and immediately inherited a massive mess. So it's not necessarily a criticism to say that she hasn't really done anything since being prime minister.
But she hasn't
really done anything since being prime minister. And obviously, I mean, when she was Home Secretary, the main thing that I was following when she was Home Secretary was her complete assault on the Human Rights Act and her seeming, I'm not sure if this is my inference or her implication, but her seeming disdain for the European Convention on Human Rights, which in my opinion is one of the greatest achievements of humanity. I mean, it's of its time and it's a little bit outdated now, but still a great piece of work. And she's always seemed to be quite down on that. So oblivious of any EU politics or right-wing politics or anything like that. And I suppose, you know, there is an element of she's very different from Cameron and that lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever you think about the politics and the whole Brexit thing, she has at least I mean, even if you're going to be a cynic and say it's all token gesture, she has at least acknowledged that there are lots of people struggling in the country who we government really ought to be doing something for.
Yeah, David Cameron's policy was more, everyone's fine, what are you talking about?
Let's have a party. Let's all go around Prince Beatrice's house and slash Ed Sheeran in the face. So, I mean, on one level, you know, it's too soon to really have an opinion on Theresa May's role as Prime Minister. But as I say, when she was Home Secretary, on one very, very fundamental issue, I had very big problems with her politics.
Yes, and obviously the one thing she has got through was something she started as Home Secretary more than once, was the Snoopers Charter.
Yes.
As it's known, that's gone into law now.
It has.
And so we're all going to have dictatorship-level intrusions into our privacy. So that's something she's achieved.
And I'm still trying to work out what her policy now is on the whole human rights thing. I mean, if it is, as some have suggested, that we not only do we pull out of the European Union, we pull out of the European Convention on Human Rights. Well, I did a really bad job of doing anything to try and influence people I know or people I know sort of back home on the whole EU vote. Having said, like, 18 months ago, I better join one of the groups or do something to support the campaign to stay within the EU. And then I did nothing. And yeah, so there you go. That's how that turned out. So if it looks like the government really is going to be pulling out of the European Convention on Human Rights, this time I'm genuinely going to give up some of my time and go and stuff envelopes for the campaign group that's been set up on that. I won't have Kate Bush helping me stuffing those envelopes by the sounds of it. Mind you, that's me concluding that because she has some admiration for Theresa May, she's really down on human rights. Which possibly isn't fair, particularly given the subject matter of some of her songs. But hey!
Well, that's it. That's it from this podcast this week. You can go and listen to our playlist on Spotify now. There's no Kate Bush in it. You don't need to worry. On our semi-approved playlist this week, we've got new music from Brutus and Sad Palace.
So go listen to those.
Check that out.
The real sound of 2017.
The real sound of 2017, yeah. Brutus are from Belgium. So there you go. That's already going further afield than the BBC's list. You can subscribe to this podcast, you know, on iTunes and SoundCloud and Mixcloud and Spotify and basically anywhere that you
Audio Boom. What else?
Well, loads, but I wasn't going to list them all because there's loads. Basically anywhere you
some of those
possibly
ones.
Get podcasts from,
yeah.
we're almost certainly on it. If we're not, and for some reason you use something that we're not on, then tell us and we'll put it on there. But basically just like subscribe, especially on iTunes. It really does help and all that stuff. That people say at the end of podcasts.
Yeah, get our subscriptions on iTunes up before Apple shut it down. Let's see if we can get as many as we can before Apple delete everything.
Okay, yeah, good. This podcast was presented by Andy Malt, that's me, Chris Cook, who knows who my guest will be next week.
I'm looking forward to finding out.
He'll be jetting in.
Ship them in from somewhere.
It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU... go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Here, have a Moomin biscuit.
I will.